Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 107. And we are live tonight on Odyssey, on DLive, and on RadioAlbion.com. Now, we are live with audio on Radio Albion. We are live with video on Radio Albion. We are live with video on Odyssey and DLive. Now, obviously, if you're having any problems with buffering or if you don't have great bandwidth, the best place to go is Radio Albion. And obviously, Radio Albion is the home of my good friend Sven Longshanks. He is the producer of excellent nationalist material. And there's so much nationalist material on that website. There is something for everybody. And I do two regular shows on there every week, one with Dr. Patrick Slattery and one at 4 p.m. live every Friday with Dr. David Duke. So please check out Radio Albion. And if you haven't subbed to me on Odyssey yet, get on Odyssey. Odyssey is an amazing platform. I'm currently building a library of every single video I've ever done on Odyssey. They are now allowing me to order them by their original date. So they're all in original date order. They are all being catalogued properly. And I have three channels there. I have one for my scripted videos, one for my live random shows. So the film reviews, the gaming, the book clubs. And I also have a channel dedicated to PWR. So you can find every episode of PWR in one place on one channel. And all replays of PWR can also be found on BitChute. So please make sure you have me subbed on Odyssey and BitChute. Now, you might have noticed I don't have any video tonight. You're probably thinking, where is Mark's video? He's always on video. Well, not tonight. I am not on video tonight. And that is because I am a little bit under the weather, unfortunately. I've got a bit of a sore throat, a few of the sniffles. Hopefully, that will be sorted for the weekend because I have a debate on Saturday night. I think it's 9 p.m. with Jeremy Poole from Wake Up UK, civic nationalism versus ethno-nationalism. And I am also doing a live stream on Friday, the monthly update for PA with Laura. So that is something to look forward to. Now, if you want to contribute to tonight's show, the best way to contribute is via Entropy. Jason will be putting the Entropy links in both of the chats. You can send paid super chats via Entropy. That is a great way to support myself and the show. We will read out all paid super chats live on the show. You can also ask unpaid questions. Unpaid questions are voted on. The best questions get voted up, the less good questions go down, and we ask the best questions every week. You can also donate to me via crypto, and now is a good time to donate via crypto because the market's in a bit of a dip. You can get all my cryptos on my Gab, on my Telegram, or by writing to me at Mark at the Fall of Western Man. You can also write to me at Mark at the Fall of Western Man. If you need any help, if you want to comment on anything I'm doing, if you want to give me your opinion, that is a great way to contact me. And you can contact me there if you want to donate via other means such as bank transfer. Now, obviously, I am not on social networks. So if you want to like and share these streams, that would be massively helpful. If you want to make sure as many people hear about this stream, that would be absolutely fantastic. Because we have an absolutely wonderful guest with us tonight, Paul English, who I will be introducing very shortly. But before we go over to Paul, I'm going to pass you over to Jason and say, how are you doing tonight, my friend? Have you had a good week? And who is on tap?
I could not be more magnificent. The week has been magnificent. And don't know quite yet know who's going to be on tap, but we are going to find somebody and it's going to be really wonderful when we do. The show will be fantastic and we look forward to seeing all of you there. I want to share one of our great content producers, Lovely Porridge, and I will pop his URL into, I guess it's the YouTube URL for Lovely Porridge. He's a magnificent servant to white well-being. We deeply appreciate him, and I'll share his URL in a minute. And folks, if you don't know, prior to the show, the PWRs, we rock out a little bit. You chat, and we rock. I play mainstream rock music and hang out with you all. If you want to be a part of that, then make sure you make your way over to any one of my channels, except for the YouTube one, because obviously I won't be playing mainstream rock music over there. Channel be gone in heartbeat. Well, we had, let's see, over the past week, I had a working dinner for White Wellbeing. We're organizing a lot of things going on in the background that are very exciting, and speed is picking up. So these meetings have to take place, and we had we're prepping for two conferences coming up later this year, and one of them is going to be one heck of a party. Looking forward to that in just a couple of months, and being able to tell everybody about that. Like I said, things are really picking up steam. I also met, I don't know if I mentioned last week, but I got to meet Jared George in person, and we actually did the TAP episode 2 weeks ago together. And this past week, I also got to meet the dear lady Carlisle Cockatoo in person, and both of those were magnificent meetings. Finally, I'll just say this past week, we had Andrew Torba take a photograph of a bumper sticker that one of our magnificent champions in service to White Wellbeing, I don't even know who this champion is, we have to celebrate him or her anonymously, put up a bumper sticker on the back of a road sign, and Andrew Torba got a photograph of it and then gabbed it, obviously went to the website, nowhiteguilt.org, and took a photograph of it, gabbed it on his platform, and then watched the show that we did on Going Free on Sunday, because he was able to share the exact minute mark where we started talking about him and the sign and the bumper sticker. So deeply appreciative to Torba, and thank you very much, good brother. Thank you for being who you are and doing what you're doing. But that is all I will say, because I'm very eager to get over to Paul and begin the conversation tonight. Thank you so much for being here with us, Paul. Mark?
Well, thank you very much, Jason. Now, Paul English is someone who was actually a guest that many, many people asked me to get on. And he was first introduced to our audience when we were doing the PA Book Club. We did a review of Hellstorm, which is a must-read book. And Paul is the narrator of the audiobook. And his narration is not only excellent, but his discussion of that topic on that particular evening, if you haven't checked out that book review, it's up on BitChute. It'll be up on my Odyssey channel soon as I'm uploading the videos day by day. But his commentary was absolutely superb, and everyone in the chat was saying, get this man on PWR. Now, he does a lot more than simply narrating audiobooks. He also appears on a weekly show with Andrew Carrington Hitchcock every Monday, and he played a leading role in setting up European folk radio. This guy is an amazing voice for our movement. I don't hear enough of this guy. He needs to be invited on more shows. And hopefully after tonight, lots more people will invite him on their shows, because I think he's got some excellent takes. He was very, very entertaining when he was on the book review. So without any further ado, please give a big round of applause for Paul English. Paul, if you can tell us a little bit about yourself, tell us what brought you to the movement, tell us what you do and how we can support your work and where we can find it.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for the ridiculously over the top introduction. I don't quite know how to sort of roll through from that. I don't normally hear things like that, but it's very kind of you to say it. It's funny, really. I wasn't looking at nationalism or anything to do with race 25, 27 years ago, but I was looking into banking at the time. I'm not a banker, you'll be relieved to know, but I basically in the 80s, I was a copywriter, and then I went freelance in the early 90s, and I just happened to go freelance at the time when the internet came along, so I never got much freelance work done, because as soon as I was introduced to this, I sort of just got hoovered into it, because there was Usenet and all these other sort of discussion groups going on, so this is... I'm just telling you how old I am. You get some idea. Some people weren't even born, I suppose, back then. A lot of people, actually. But it was fascinating. As a copywriter and a marketeer, sorry to mention that, but I was, although it's looming much larger in my thinking now, is marketing, that dreadful word. But I just found it absolutely fascinating. Anyway, I ended up bumping and hanging around with certain guys from Cambridge that used to come down to this facility in London. They would come down and use it for hacking purposes over the weekend. And they were exactly the same as I think they are now. They all ate pizzas and talked very strange language. And I liked them a lot, actually. And they were very bright. And they just love to sit and hack through code. Whilst I was there, there were a series of meetings that used to be held after hours, sort of like on a Friday night or on a Sunday afternoon. We were allowed to use the space. And at one of these meetings, a chap rolled up who was invited by somebody else. And he was very, very softly spoken, a very different sort of person. And I ended up getting to know him. And this would be from about 94 onwards, about 1994 onwards. And he started to give me newsletters that he was writing. And what was in these newsletters was were topics that I'd never seen before. I didn't even know you could discuss things. For example, the criminal history of the British Isles and why it had been such a preferred hiding place for the criminal class of Europe for centuries and how that was set up. The manipulation of pop music. Now, this is before I'd seen any of this on the net. This is 94, 95. Most of this sort of information wasn't readily available on the internet at that time. And then he started to tell me about banking, and I couldn't stop meeting up with him and listening to what he was talking about. And after about a year of this, so we get to about 95, I realized that up to that point, I knew nothing about anything, nothing at all. Everything that he'd presented and shown to me, and he used to back it up with evidence and bring banking documents along and everything. So I learned how world finance works and who pulls the strings. And how disgusting it all is. And he was a very strange man, very strange, highly intelligent, but dyslexic, often goes hand in hand, very creative, very softly spoken. And just to give you an indication of his character or his qualities, he used to keep notes in our meeting in a language I didn't understand. I said, "What is that?" He said, "Oh, that is my own version of Arabic shorthand." I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "Well, I'm the only person in the world that can read it." He said, "So I can leave all my documents around the office." So I started off sort of like in a secret squirrel spy novel. I'm quite serious. There were literally things like in some of the offices that he managed, there were sliding library frames and hidden panels, electrified carpets, underground tunnels went off in another place, right? He told me about all the location spots for literally caverns of cash kept all around London, guarded by mafiosi and other people. And I got all this evidence. I mean, he'd actually bought as well. He bought up one of the old nuclear bunkers that the British government had had during the Cold War on this farmland. And he'd bought it up from the farmer because they'd left it. And it was full of the most amazing things. Anyway, although I liked him personally, I'm sorry, this is slightly off beam, but it's just to give you a background. Although I got on with him well, he was very, very dangerous. And I didn't realize just how dangerous he was, but it was very dangerous for me. And I ended up at the High Court in London, the one that's on TV. So at least I went to a proper court for 3 days over what we'd been doing, which was to try and redistribute profits back to the people of England. And that's what motivated me. It's, in retrospect, it's embarrassingly naive. Right, it really is. And I walked into it like a complete idiot and was totally set up for something else that he was doing. It got more intriguing because he never bothered turning up to the court case during the 3 days that it ran, which disconcerted me considerably. I was calling him and said, "You're the number one defendant. Why are you not in court?" And he would say, "I'm not very interested in being in court with these people." He said, "I've got my people in the court, you know." Anyway, this went on, but it turned out that he had people, for example, people from the DTI were spying on him, and he knew this because he had people in the DTI working for him, and I got these reports on my desk. So it got very, very strange and surreal. Anyway, I'd basically been used as bait for him, and I ended up in a lot of trouble, and it kind of put a massive sort of hole in my life in the year 2000. And I was still in London at the time, just got married. And then me and my wife moved out of London because it was a silly place, couldn't really afford to live there. And I've been living on the South Coast ever since. And even though I hail from Yorkshire and do need to get back there, Mark, you'll be pleased to know. I've got plans slowly building up in my head to get back. But from that point on, from about 2000 onwards, as soon as we moved down here, I had a real bee in my bonnet because something had come at me and sort of wiped everything out, and I didn't fully understand what it was. So I had a direct experience of being of having my life really, really crushed. And for the next 5 years, I had to live almost sort of like a cash existence, hand by mouth, to get things through. So that was a very stressful sort of period because we just got married and we'd got two children and all this kind of stuff. So that was quite stressy. Anyway, in between all of that, I've done a lot of reading, and most of it up to about 2010 or 11 or 12 was to do with banking. You'll be thrilled to hear. Let's all talk about banking, shall we? And but it is, I still remain clear in my own mind that until the bank is dealt with, very little else will be. And it's a point of continual amusement and distress to me when I speak to people about it, because, you know, everybody goes to school, they teach you English and maths, but there's two things, and maybe we touched on this, Mark, when I was on with Tom and Dave, you know, a few weeks back. But they teach you those things, but they do not teach you about the law, and they do not teach you about banking. And of course, if you go to an adolescent boy in England who's 14 or 15 and say, hey, we've got some banking and law classes for you, they're not going to jump all over you and say, this is just what I've been dying to learn about. But unfortunately for all of us, those, in terms of pragmatic forces, my observation is that those are the heaviest, most mean-spirited and ruinous forces that fall upon all of us. And you come out of school with not a clue about how it works. Even graduates from degree courses in economics do not study central banking other than for a couple of hours and how it all works. And it seems to me, even if you take an engineering approach to this, and I try to take an engineering approach in my thinking to all of the things that we're looking at, you know, there's banking, there's race, there's culture, there's media, all of these things that are twisted away from how we want them. An engineering approach for me works. I'm trying to look at how you make the thing work, how you simplify it. Where is the sticking point in these things? The sticking point with the banking is that you and I, all the people in America, all the people in Western Christian nations or the remnants thereof, do not own the bank. And that's a massive, massive problem. So we don't have any say at all in the control of this spigot where all the stuff comes from. And it's a very, very damaging condition that we're in. And of course, from that, once I'd realized these mechanics that were at play, you start to read history books with a totally different perspective. That was the first thing. And you begin to see that obviously with the advent of the Bank of England over here in 1694, really, the English have not been in charge of their nation for about 300 years and possibly longer than that. And so that twisted everything away. And I suddenly found that most of the things that I'd been taught at school that I thought were true, and I'm sure it's a similar experience for many people listening and maybe you guys here too, you suddenly realize that everything that you'd been taught is complete crap, taught by people who were honestly teaching you what they thought was the truth, but that they'd never been invited to those other conversations where you really get to see how it goes on. So that's what's moved me through. Banking started it off. It is a very boring topic. I do understand that, which is part of its power, by the way. It puts everybody to sleep so fast that nobody can get to the bottom of working out how it's actually ruined their lives. But then, you know, all of our enemies, as it were, those that are in charge of the power centers right now, they are supported by that system. At the end of this month, they're all getting paid. I'm not. I don't know about you guys, but I don't get paid too much. I manage to bumble my way through, but they get paid. And that's the big difference between them and us. They're covered by this corrupt system, and we're not. And this makes our fight, of course, considerably more arduous and difficult, but I do believe there's a way through. So I don't know if I've really answered your thing about the nationalism. Maybe we can cover that a little bit more. But the race issue is obviously key. Particularly the misunderstandings, I would suggest, about race by most of my kith and kin here in these islands, and no doubt elsewhere in the Western Christian world, what's left of it.
Well, thank you. That's a very comprehensive answer, and very, very interesting as well. It's not often we talk about banking a lot, but if anyone wants to ask questions, they can do so through Entropy. I'd be happy to put any questions about banking to Paul. But I was obviously introduced to you because you were the narrator of the audio version of Hellstorm. And as I said earlier, you came on our review of Hellstorm. And it was an excellent, excellent show. In fact, despite the very dark nature of what we were discussing, the overall presentation, that book review, was something that I got a huge number of emails about saying how much people enjoyed it, the fact that we actually did such a deep dive into such an excellent book. How did you get involved with the narration of Hellstorm? And do you want to give any quick thoughts on that? Because obviously that was a really, it is an amazingly important project. And when I say a project, I think it's more than just a book, because obviously there's the audiobook, the documentary. There's a wealth of evidence there. And just for the record, I said this at the time, it was one of the few things I've actually watched in my life. I didn't read the book. I watched the documentary, and I actually found it difficult to watch. I had to stop several times and watch it in parts, because it is just so gruesome and so heart-wrenching what happened that I just couldn't digest it all in one sitting.
No. No, well, I won't talk about banking too much, but it is actually the thread into Hellstorm, because what actually, as I was studying more and more of this stuff, one comes across the historical accounts of what happened on Wall Street, of what happened with the advent of the Federal Reserve. These things are all important for, with regards to, you know, the base foundation of huge parts of World War II as we know it. And so I got drawn into looking at the National Socialist Economic Miracle, as it's sometimes referred to. I know there are many people that disparage it. We may have touched on that as well. You know, they say, well, he took money from the Ford Motor Company, to which I would say, good on him. I mean, I would do exactly the same thing. But that's a period, of course, of in the history of that country that's not touched upon too much. I mean, there are many people that are knowledgeable about it, and in these spaces, probably quite a bit. But in general terms, you're not likely to see many documentaries covering that aspect of what they did to recover. I was very interested in this because there was something in the mechanics of what they were doing that was sound, profoundly sound, you know, to get 6 million men. Well, there were 7 million unemployed, and you got about 5 million back to work in about a year and a half. You go, how do you do that? Well, the circumstances were slightly different, but it can be done. And they did it in a particular way. And it's a combination of factors that they used. And of course, this created this tension, this situation. One then starts to read about the arrogance of the British elites in the early 20th century, Lord Grey and these other types, hanging around, who couldn't tolerate the idea of Germany, this upstart nation, giving them a run for the money in the industrial stakes. But that was definitely what was happening. And there was an ambassador in London in the early 1900s who was having a discussion with him. He said, well, why don't you just compete them? And he said, no, we just go to war. So, you know, World War One was already being thought about in 1906, 1907. These are the people that have been in charge of this nation, who were quite happy to squander everything that had been built up. You know, there's all sorts of questions about that as well. But that's how I got into really looking at World War II. Generally, to start off with, was, you know, because to fight a war, you need armaments, and to get armaments, you need money. And when you understand the money, follow the money, follow the money, you realize that none of these events can take place unless bankers open the sluice gates and drive finance here, or cut it off from there, or do this and do that. So it's, you know, it's labyrinthine, it's complex, but they're able to do that. And of course, that leads you to the Jewish question, because you find out, of course, that most of the banking houses are driven and controlled and organized by the Babylonian banking system, to use the old term, and that there's a certain type of person that's predominant in it. It's not exclusively them, but predominantly them. And you start to stitch these things together. So that led me onto a wider review of the whole of World War II as an event. I didn't come to it as a sort of somebody who was very keen to know about the battles or anything like that. That wasn't my point of interest. It was to try and find out the foundation for it as best I could. I guess it's a process, Mark, that never ends. I mean, people are still, and rightfully, you know, twiddling away at it and looking at it and saying, well, I wasn't aware of this, and I come across new things all the time. But it's such a pivotal event because we're living in the shadow of that. So when I saw Tom's book, to come up to this, and I first got exposed to it, I guess I must have been aware of it for a couple of years before I even read it. So it came out about 2010, I think. I'd kind of seen adverts for it. I got a copy. I contacted Tom, like I was saying before. He kindly wrote a little note in the front of the book for me, because it was I contacted him directly. He just happened to have a few copies left. And he said some very nice words, just because I'd exchanged a few emails with him. I read the book. And in exactly the same way as you said, and as we covered before, it's quite an experience to read that book. And it's not really something you can describe to someone. You just have to give it to them and say, read it. I suspect you're going to have a pretty heavy experience reading this book. And it's an experience that people ought to have, in my view, because it puts things in an extremely clear light, very clear, about the colossal human wreckage and damage that was caused by that. And it was caused to our people. And it's a huge part of the whole thing. It brings this, you know, the first person view. You're actually almost like in the trousers of these people that are going through this stuff as you read the book. And it was for that reason that I contacted Tom a few years later. I think it was 2018. And I just got lucky on the day that I called him. I mean, we'd exchanged a few emails, but he was moving around Europe at the time. And I just happened to catch him, and he said, "You're the second person today that said that to me." And so it was, you know, maybe serendipitous that should come about. And so he said, "Sure, give it a go." So I did. And I sent him a few rushes, and he said, "That's great. Let's do the whole thing." So I did, you know. It was a different experience narrating it, because I had to take a sort of unemotional, I couldn't get involved as a reader, if you know what I mean. It's a bit strange, but I couldn't, because I thought, well, if you start emoting with this thing, you know, I'm going to run out of scales to go to, you know, you're going to hit really heavy bits very, very quickly, and I've got nowhere else to go. So we better just keep it straight and as clean as we can. And that was the attempt there. So, you know, and I found it's led to all sorts of other things, like being here. And I felt really privileged that Tom allowed me to do it. That's how I feel about it. Maybe in the future someone will do another version, will be better than that one. And I don't mind. I just wanted to do it. I thought, well, we get it out and let's see what happened. But it's made all sorts of other connections for me, more into the nationalist community, I suppose, if that's what we want to call it.
Well, it's very interesting. Everything you have said so far, it's quite the personal journey and story that you share. I am curious, because in the U.S. here, we have, for those of us who have bothered to follow the banking rabbit trail, perhaps you know, Paul, we had I think it was the Bank of North America, and then the Bank of the U.S., and then the Second Bank of the U.S. Each time, these external private banks being taken down by the legislatures of the United States. And then, of course, the biggest takedown by the one and only great Andrew Jackson, and gave the United States freedom for 80 years. It's interesting, though, by the way, as soon as the United States was free, the bankers were immediately at the throats of those who were in charge with their typical games of we'll make all your problems go away and make all your dreams come true. And if you don't also play along, then we'll bring hell to your family, and just how they operate, mafiosi style. And then, of course, we had the 1913 Fed Reserve, and that's where we are, no more federal than Federal Express. That's mm-hmm. where we are today. And I've been curious. I haven't had the time to investigate. And I wonder if you just might, for a moment, so we don't get really sidetracked, but for those listeners who are both in the UK and around the world who will be listening to this live and in replay, you mentioned about 300 years ago that the banking was taken away from those in the UK. I wonder if you might speak just briefly to some of that history and how that took place, and if there are any family names or anything of that nature that you know of and you would want to share, and how it unfolded.
Sure. The dates, 1694, I think, when the Bank of England was formed, and they'd been running up to it for some time. I mean, during the mid-1600s here, apart from having the delightful Civil War, which was the opening shot in a revolution which is yet to end, I'm paraphrasing Isaac Disraeli, the father of Benjamin, who did this a whole book about Charles the First. And that's also featured in The Nameless War, which I'd recommend to anybody. A very brief, about 90-100 pages long document. In fact, I'm thinking of doing an audiobook of that, because it's so crisp and full of such salient points, highly relevant to today. But what had occurred is that Cromwell is the beginning of laying in this foundation. So if we go back a little bit earlier, Edward Longshanks issues this edict of expulsion in 1291, I think it is, that the Jews may no longer reside in England. So apparently all off they all go, reasonably peaceably with their goods and services. There's no sort of great thing about that. Although I suspect, and there's evidence to suggest, that many of them went to Wales, but that doesn't really matter. Anyway, England then flourishes, or not, depending on how you want to spin it, over the next few hundred years. This is when, during the 1300s and 1400s, people were working about 26 weeks a year, which is not too bad. And they were building up quite a bit of wealth through sheep and all sorts of other things. I mean, it's a detailed thing, but that's what was taking place. Henry VIII comes along and we've got a massive problem. So for me personally, history from Henry VIII forward is highly relevant to most of today, because what happened with Henry, everybody knows about the Reformation, but the devastation would be a better description of it. And he basically nicked all this stuff from the Catholic Church. We got a period then of capitalism so intense where people, this is where you get, you know, your archetypical peasant and your incredibly revolting lord who's distanced by, you know, rivers of cash or whatever from the life of the peasants. And that's where it all got laid in. So if we move forward a little bit to Cromwell, we have this situation in Parliament where it's getting out of order, and Cromwell is basically supported by Manasseh ben Israel, I think it is, out of Holland, and they were looking for a naval country on which to attach themselves. Let's put it that way. It's a rather a vexatious word, but I think it's true. And so England we're basically making a lot of ships. I mean, it's all to do with the technology of the time, and the technology of the time was ships, and we were able to make a lot of them, and there's a lot of water around here. So off we go. So they come in here. Cromwell's new model army is paid for by them. That's why it was so well equipped. They paid for it. There was an armament supplier called Carvajal, I think he is, another Jew from Spain, who provided all the armaments into the new model army. Cromwell was barking mad half the time anyway. And he got to the end where they had to organize and assassinate Charles I. They had to basically do it. There were no grounds to actually kill him. In fact, the house, I think it's coming up to, I can't remember which year it is, they'd all agreed that the concessions made by the king were good enough and that was fine. This was spelled absolute doom for Cromwell, because he was going to get his money and everything else, the rest of it, as long as they got rid of Charles. So they had to, the whole execution of Charles is a setup from start to finish. They kind of allowed him to escape and arrested him to create all these causative reasons and this, that, and the other. And from that point forward, this country was lost, I would suggest. There was a massive rebellion at the time from the politicians in the House of Parliament about the readmission of the Jews, because that was one of Cromwell's, that was one of the things he had to fulfill. And they were not happy about this. So it didn't go down easy. They said, this is ridiculous. You know, this is completely counter to the Christian traditions and blah, 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 blah. But hey ho, it didn't make any difference. I mean, we're familiar with this process anyway, I guess, to right up to the present day. The voice of the little person doesn't count for too much. And it didn't count for too much back then either. And so it only took them, 20 years or so, to get everything in place to set up a central bank. Now, it wasn't the first central bank in the world. The first one was in Holland, but it's obviously become the predominant one. And the reason for central banking, because it's part of communism, is to introduce ultimately progressive income taxes, but basically to make the wealth of the nation, to have that as collateral for any debts that it runs up. You know, why bother lending to the barrel maker when you can lend to the whole nation? So that's kind of what happened. And I think when they, yet again, you mentioned the Federal Reserve, right? So when the Federal Reserve was set in motion, it was at Christmas. Everybody had gone home. I think there were about 8 people in the house at the time, and no one had even known it had gone on. Well, it was exactly the same with the formation of the Bank of England in 1694, except they did it in August in the summer, because most of the politicians at the time were farmers. And so they had to go back to their farms to bring in the crop. Just had to go and do it. So there's no one around. So they slipped this bill through, or whatever it was at the time, whilst everybody was away. So you see, the pattern is exactly the same over and over and over again. You get people distracted, and then you can, while they're looking the other way, you can get these things in place. It only took them about, since 1694, before the century was out, they'd run up debts of like 3 million quid almost instantaneously. And then they got into this whole thing about issuing more money than there is gold to back it up and so on and so forth on a more of an industrial scale. And away we go. So that's the beginning of modern banking. We may be, I suppose, in our present age at the end of that type of banking, although the principles of abuse are still going to be there unless we get these buggers out, if you see what I'm saying. So if that gives a bit of a background, that's, I mean, it's a big topic. I mean, I could talk for ages and ages and ages about it, but that's kind of that. Those are the main foundations to it. That's how it all came about. Yeah.
And then war, of course, the use of casus belli, and then the subsequent détente and rapprochements are all not necessarily initiated, but could be. But are made use of by these entities so that there's profit for them heading both directions, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they fund both sides of the war. And that's, you know, and they did that in World War II, and they did that in World War I, and they've done that in every single war. And if you look at that period from the English Civil War for the European people in Europe, it's been nonstop war since then. Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. I think there's something like since 1694, this country has not been in war only three of those years. Only three out of something like 380 or whatever it is. It's absolutely mad. And we never had a war with Germany prior to 1914. So, you know, it's organized. These things are obviously organized. I think many people are aware of this now, but it's a relatively new realization for a lot of people. And for many people out there, it's maybe a piece of information they're never going to come across in the normal walk of life because, you know, the main thing that they have used their money for is to control the media. I mean, it's interesting, you know, the amount of pamphlets during the English Civil War, there was something like 30,000 pamphlets printed in London. This is in the mid-1600s. And they managed to organize a mob, all paid for. I don't know how, but it was obviously paid for. They could drum up 10,000 men out of London to march all over the place. And it's no different to what's happening now. They would attack the royalists, then they would attack Cromwell supporters. They were sent both ways to actually agitate in both directions. You see it repeated then in the French Revolution, which was planned and designed from London. The French Revolution. It was a London design, Continental Club and the other club, these two gentlemen's clubs full of masons, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So we've got all that. I mean, you know, how relevant this is today for most people, I guess it's a lot of information to plow through. Maybe, well, some of us will and some of us won't. But the key principles are that, you know, I think the controllers in the background are still there and all we get is actors out front. And there's nothing profound about that. I'm sure you both know that. But I think I just keep reminding myself because, you know, the power of the TV and the repetition gets people convinced at times that the people on it are the ones that are actually in charge of things. And they're not. They're just actors, really. It's been like that for a long time.
Well, that is very, very informative. I didn't think we were going to end up going down this particular route in such depth. Is there anything?
Neither did I.
No, but I think it's very important, and I think that talking about these things and educating people is a vital part of what we do. I often talk about the different purposes of nationalism, and I'm actually giving a talk on Thursday, a lecture to a Swedish group about how nationalism's gone wrong in the past and ways that we're trying to fix it. And one of the things I've talked about is how nationalism is or used to be tied in the 2000s to the electoral boom and bust cycle. So we were just trapped in this. If we were doing well electorally, the movement grew. If we were doing poorly electorally, the movement shrank. So you saw a massive growth in the movement between 2001 and 2004. But come the European parliamentary elections in 2004, the party shrank. And then in 2006, it boomed again up until 2009 and 2010. It totally shrank and to the point where it disappeared. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I think nationalism should get away from. I still think we should be involved in elections and electioneering. I still think fighting for power is important. But I do think education and community building and other different aspects of the movement should be put just as centrally to our focus as electioneering or the electoral boom and bust cycle, as I call it, because something like this, a deep dive into who is behind the banking, the way that the banking sector has manipulated European nations into these brothers wars, I think all of these things are actually very important. And I don't think anyone would think this is dry commentary. I think this is very, very deep, very, very important, and is actually central to our struggle. So, you know, thank you for talking about that. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this, Jason? Because obviously, here in Britain, there is this kind of mentality, which is completely untrue, that Germany was threatening Britain. Britain was this sort of plucky little underdog that had to fight back. Britain stood up for itself against the big German bully and overcame all the odds, when this is actually completely untrue. Britain was spoiling for war with Germany long before the outbreak of the Second World War. And in fact, the first bombs dropped were British bombs on German industrial centres. And it was actually Germany that wanted peace with Britain, not the other way around. And much of the drive for the Second World War wasn't actually anything to do with what children are taught about in schools today, but was actually caused by the fact that many powerful bankers and industrialists in Britain feared a continental superpower that could, in effect, rival the British Empire. And if Germany had gone east and were uninhibited by the West, Germany would have created a powerful racialist, national socialist bloc stretching from Germany right up through Russia. And they would have undoubtedly been successful in that if it hadn't been for Britain and America both arming the Russians and creating a war on the Western Front. But this was something that British imperialists actually feared, not because they were thinking about the good of the Russian people, not because of this modern day claptrap that, you know, Britain had to step in to save Jews. None of that is true. It was all about British industrialists not wanting the British Empire to have a continental rival.
Well, it is definitely fascinating history, and I think there's a thread there that maybe Paul can speak to. The it seems like this perennial bellicosity, whenever there is a challenge to those who run and maintain this central banking cabal, we instantly see the dehumanization. And I wonder perhaps if you can speak to that, both if you would like, over the past couple hundred of years, all the way up to the present, and I guess just generally,
the war side, you mean?
Yeah.
In terms of agitating for war.
Yes.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, just coming back to what you were saying, Mark, about the underpinnings of the banking. That's why the people in Hellstorm died. Is one of the main things. I mean, if you've got I'm interested in National Socialist Germany when it was booming, not when it was being destroyed. You see, there's also a thread which I say is this. I mean, you know, we can probably improve it, but it goes like this. If you take your nation and make it serve its actual people, you do that, they will bomb you. They did it with Germany. They did it with Gaddafi. They do it with anybody that's going to turn the power of the nation, the economy of the nation, to the benefit of the people, which, of course, is how it ought to be. It's actually the only way it really can work if you want to have a life of some dignity, something which we're all basically robbed of to a great degree. You have to work at it. But it's difficult. We've got this vexatious pest chewing away at things, and that's how it does it. So I often used to think, you know, what would it be like to go to Germany in 1936 or 1937? If you're an international banker, you wouldn't want anybody going to Germany during that period. Why? Because what would they see? They go, hey, didn't you have 6 million men sitting around doing nothing? in 1933. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's true, yeah. But we've built all these autobahns and done all this now. Yeah, we've done all that. We've got sorted. Why? Well, because we've issued a currency that's in part based on the work of the people. These solutions are available to us right now, here today. What's going to happen, for example, right now? This COVID thing is just a cover for this economic readjustment crap. It always is. It's always banking every single time. Is they're going to start spinning some stories. They've got several that they could run. One of them possibly is this. They'll go, we were desperately trying to save you all. Honest, really. And unfortunately, the economy's tanked. We've ruined it. So the only way to sort it out now is we've got to go fully digital, you see, and we're going to have this fully encrypted system. It's going to be great. You're going to love it. It's going to be really, really good. And what we're going to save so much money in the economy that we're going to be able to recover. Isn't that super, everyone? And people are going to go, yeah, please, you know, because I've got to get my beer again or whatever it is. And it'll probably work. It will probably work. Germany was a massive embarrassment in the world. Imagine you've got a country that's running on a system completely counter to central banking. And it's embarrassed all the Western countries totally. Roosevelt hated Hitler because Hitler sorted his country out in 3 years and Roosevelt couldn't have done it ever because he was a complete boob, right? Same here in our nation, you know. And it's this comes down to this petty nonsense between these retarded inbred numpties that are in charge of things. They're not great. The problem we've got is that the people that are in the leadership positions are mediocre. They're cunning, they're clever, but they've got an ounce of wisdom. I'm not saying anything new here, but I just like to say sometimes. That's what we've got going on. They had TVs in Berlin in 1936 for the Olympics in the cafes. No one talks about that much. I think it's quite an amazing thing for a country that was on its uppers 3 years prior to that. And look at the spirit of the country. All of these things are actually transmitted to us outside of language, no matter how much memes they do about that thing. You look at that and you go, those people look to be really strong, happy, and vibrant. So there are many amazing things that happened there. It wasn't perfect by any means, but it was their way of doing it under those circumstances at that particular time. You can't have people going there. I mean, all these heads of state would go to Germany, and what they're going to do? They're going to, hey, how did you do this? Oh, we did this, this, and this. Once they start copying that, the central banking scam's over. It should have been over a long... What's held it together? Corruption, bribery, death, threats, poison, murder, ruin, every low-life bit of scummy behavior you could imagine. Pedophilia for control, all of these things, you know? That's what they do. Because it's the only way they can hang on to it. So all of the people that are in charge of these power centers are basically threatened, corrupted, coerced individuals. All of them. And have been for a long time. You know, that's why people like us here are not in that. We don't want to be in that club, you know? I don't, anyway. I don't know if it's anybody else, but I think, you know, your eternal soul is worth quite a bit more than just a little bit of fun here and now for 80 or 90 years. But that said, these 80 or 90 years that you get are important, and it's beyond disgusting that people have to be subjected to this crap. And the reason they're subjected to it in great part is they don't understand it. You know, you can't talk to people about banking. I'll tell you, I did a thing a few years ago. I used to do a thing in the pub, right? I talked to people because I just want to talk to normal people. You can't, you know, it's all right us studying these things, and some of us are going to and need to. But in the end, it seems to me, and this goes with all the challenges we've got from a communication point of view, we have to kind of boil it down as if we're an advertising agency and we're selling soap. You've got to impact fast. People's attention span, I don't know if they've even got one left, actually. It's really, really difficult. But I remember just asking, you know, guys that I knew, just having a beer. And I said, have you got any share? Because I used to call up the Bank of England. I used to do this. I used to call them up and say, can you give me a list of your shareholders? And they go, oh, we don't give out that information, sir. And I go, but you do have shareholders. Oh, we don't give out that information. Well, you've already told me that. I said, and I called after, I just get fobbed off. I wasn't expecting to get anywhere. But most people don't realize that there are shareholders in the Bank of England. And so I would say to guys in the pub, I'd say, hey, have you got shares in the Bank of England? And they go, no. Have you? They look at me and go, yeah. I said, no. And then the next question, and they would ask this, I'm not sort of making it up, they go, can you have shares in the Bank of England? I said, well, you can't. You're scum like me. I said, you're not allowed to have them, you know? I said, but it's interesting, isn't it? And the point I was trying to get across to them is that we could have an economy that runs without income tax. No, you can't. Yeah, you can. You don't need income tax at all. All of these things that people have become adjusted to, in terms of the way that the economy regulates everything. It regulates the culture because it says who's going to get the money, Tracy Emin for her bed, right? And all this other stuff, who's going to get that and who's not going to get this? And it's where the energy goes. It's like electricity is money. It just enlivens things or it deadens things if you cut it off. All of these things are possible, but they're not possible to a mind, which is most minds out there, that don't understand the mechanics of the situation in the first place. There have been some absolutely amazing economic experiments which nobody knows about. I'll give you an example. There's a during the and we can move on to something else as well. I didn't mean to get stuck on economics, but I think it's kind of key, and this is a pretty neat story. There's a town in Austria called Wörgl, W-O-R-G-L. It still exists to this day. And there's a bridge, a couple of bridges in that town, which are still standing, which were built in the 1930s. And on it, there's a little plaque. And it says, this is the bridge that we built with our own money. Here's the story. There's a mayor there in Wörgl. It's 1931. The whole world's tanked because of Wall Street. And Austria is suffering just like everybody else. A lot of people unemployed, soup kitchens, the lot. And the mayor has been a student of alternative economic practices and been studying a German economist called Silvio Gesell, who went off to Argentina and became a beef farmer and was very successful at it. Gesell made some really interesting observations about the nature of exchange. And he said, money has an unfair advantage. He said, if you're, you know, for example, let's suppose you're running a chicken farm and producing eggs. I don't know how long an egg stays an egg, but it's X number of weeks. After that, it's rotten, and therefore it's unsellable. Right. If you're producing eggs, you're under a lot of pressure to get those things shifted within that time window. This is how it works. I mean, we're talking simpler times, but the principles still apply. So what he said it's unfair. He said, you know, the seller is pressurized to keep dropping the price, whereas the holder of the money will hang out for as long as possible until he can ruin him. And this is what happens, of course. So he came up with a type of money that decayed just like the egg did. I know it sounds a bit bizarre. But this mayor in Wörgl put this money into practice. And what it was, he took 14,000 Austrian shillings of his own money, stuck it in an office in the mayor's department, and he issued 14,000 shillings worth of local scrip, as it were. And on the back of each of these notes, there were 52 squares, one for each week of the year. Okay. He had all these workmen, and he needed some new sewers. And he said, look, there's no real money around, but there is this, and I want you to do this. And so they under the yard, but they got on with it. They got on with it, right? They basically, what happened was, with inside 6 months, they got everybody in the town back to work. They built twice as many main sewage pipes as they intended. They put in railway lines in. They built this bridge. The economy was booming, and it changed the entire orientation of the thinking of the people in that village. Because what happened was, instead of people producing crappy plastic shitty goods, which we have to endure today, which break after 2 or 3 years because of the built-in obsolescence garbage, right? They started to make things that really lasted. Because when you got one of these notes, you had to go down to the post office on a Saturday at 12 o'clock, and you had to stick a stamp on it. And if you didn't, it wasn't valid for exchange. So if you handed it to someone, they go, oh, you haven't put stamps on back here, lad. I ain't taking that. So I guess there's a lot of licking of stamps going on back then. This was so spectacular. There was another village about 90 miles down the valley. It's an Austrian valley, right? So it's a bit of a hole. He hears about this. He comes up to see this mayor called Unter Guggenberger, by the way. Just, I know you're all taking notes. And he says, could we do this? He said, sure. He said, I'll tell you what, you do it down that end, we'll do it, and we'll trade up and down the valley. So they did. Same result. Everybody got back to work. Everything starts to take off. Not borrowing a penny from the central banks, right? Nothing. Just going from nothing to something. Well, became a sensation. So the following year, they call all the mayors of Austria together for this meeting. And Unter Guggenberger is called to present the facts and the data, which he did with a series of charts, 1931 style, I guess, whatever they must have looked like. I would have loved to have been there. There's about 140 mayors in the room. And he puts it to him. He said, this is what's happened. This is what happened. We could roll this out across the whole of the country. We could all connect our little cantons or whatever they're called, the regions that they've got over there. And who's on for it? Everybody was on for it. Everyone. Did it happen? No. Why did it not happen? Because 3 days later, the president of Austria got a letter, got a note from the central banking scumballs, as he would. They said, oh, we've heard about your new idea, and it's obviously very, very good, but we don't approve. And if you put it into operation, we will crash the Austrian shilling on all the world exchanges and ruin your country. That's how it works. Okay. So we're dealing with mafioso tactics at that level. That's why I wanted to tell the story. So there are spectacular possibilities. And what it does is it demystifies money and it changed the orientation of the people because, for example, when they built a when they went to buy a table, they didn't want to buy another one. It was too much of a faff buying things with this money. So they wanted a table that was going to last for 50 years. So the quality of workmanship went up. It also changed house design because they started to design and build houses with huge storage spaces so they could buy in bulk and look after things longer. And all this economy of scale, it's got some tremendous knock-on effects. Now, I'm not saying we could implement that here in Europe in 2021 in this delightful world that we find ourselves living in, but I just use it to illustrate a point. Because no one really pays too much attention to how it works in a terrible way and think that you have to pay income tax, believe you me, you do not. You do not need to pay it at all. And there's a psychological disease taking place within governments, which is that they create problems to which they are the solution as a permanent scam. That's not really a profound thought. I'm sure most people have thought it, but that is exactly what's going on. And you will have noticed in wartime, there's never a shortage of money for war. But apparently there's going to be a shortage of money for peace because that doesn't serve the interests of those that seek to control and dominate all life down here. And, you know, no one points that out either. So you've got people working for a wage. We live in a so-called capitalist society, the remnant of it. But capitalism is basically ultimately a path to communism, I'm afraid, as is democracy and these other things, because they are designed by this small cartel of arseholes. And we have to find some way of sticking them on an island so they can stay happy and not interfere with us trying to build Hobbiton, to use an analogy, because I think, you know, we want these villages that are wholesome. That's the kind of life I think we resonate to. I do, anyway. And I think you see the essence of that to a great degree in Germany in the 30s, when you see those happy, smiling Hausfrauen and those buoyant, stable families. You go, I want a bit of that. That looks sane. That looks sound. That's right, that is. And it is. It's absolutely right.
Well, this has been a phenomenal beginning to this show. I've got to say, this has been pretty much mind-blowing stuff, and I've been loving every minute of it. Do you want to continue down this vein? Because I was going to talk about... blooming hell, we've done the first hour of the show already. Well, let's just segue a little bit here, because there is something I did want to speak about, which is sort of... mainstream news this week, and I think it is important that we address it, and it is a race issue. And that's obviously the shooting of Sasha Johnson, the BLM protester, the leader of the Taking the Initiative party, the woman who calls herself or is called the Black Panther of Oxford. Now, she's a 26-year-old single mum. She was out on the early hours, I believe it was either a Sunday morning or a Monday morning, partying at some party, which apparently was attended by some very unsavory people. It was allegedly full of gang members. What a mother of 26 years of age is doing at a party attended by gangsters, I don't know. Surely she should be looking after her two children, but she wasn't. She was at this party, and a rival gang turned up and they opened fire on alleged gang members at this party, and Sasha Johnson took a bullet to the head. But the interesting thing about this is, in the wake of her shooting, nearly the entire sort of leftist Twitter establishment, etc., were all coming out trying to spin this as that she had been assassinated by someone that they didn't exactly say it, but they were more or less alluding to a quote unquote white supremacist bursting into this. What they were obviously trying to portray as some peaceful garden party, you know, a good old fashioned English garden party taking place at 3 a.m. with the lovely Sasha Johnson and I'm sure her culturally enriched friends. By the way, you know, this is obviously sarcasm if you haven't got this by now. And as this other gang, this rival gang, burst in, they opened fire and killed her. But they wanted to play it out as if there was this cultured garden party going on. A bitter white supremacist burst in, took his chance and shot her in the head. And people were talking about all these threats to her life. All of the nasty white people who had been sending her these awful threats because she was a fighter for racial justice. And I'll read you one of these tweets. This particular tweet is from Diane Abbott. A black activist, hashtag Sasha Johnson, in hospital in critical condition after sustaining a gunshot wound to the head. Nobody should have to potentially pay with her life because they stood up for racial justice. Hashtag Black Lives Matter. I mean, the whole subtext of that tweet is that she was shot because she was a racial equality campaigner, because she's had something to do with BLM. Now, she didn't get shot at all because she stood against racial injustice. She got shot because she was partying at 3 a.m. with members of a black gang and got caught in the crossfire. But I wanted to bring this up because I think this is something that is actually worth talking about, at least for a little time before we go to the super chats, because she wasn't the only person to make these comments. There were numerous people on Twitter, Claudia Webb, saying, you know, there was still too many guns and violent weapons damaging many lives. Well, it wasn't a gun or a violent weapon that damaged anyone's life. It was a black gang member who pulled the trigger. You can't blame inanimate objects for damage caused by people who wield them. But I just found this absolutely amazing that the entire establishment jumped on this, tried to paint it to be an angry white man who did this. And in fact, it's black on black crime, which really underlines the whole point, or the whole fallacy of Black Lives Matter, should I say, because the vast majority of black people who die prematurely via or meet a violent end do so at the hands of other black people. And I just found it rather ironic that Sasha Johnson would meet this end. Well, she's not actually dead yet, but would end up in hospital, not at the hands of what the liberal media wanted it to be, not at the hands of some white supremacist trying to assassinate her, but in fact at the hands of another black, because she was mixing with such a terrible crowd. And I just wanted your take on that, Paul, and also yours, Jason, because I just thought this was a particularly interesting and illustrative story.
Yeah, do you want me to go first?
Yeah, you are the guest, my friend, and you've been astounding tonight, so I am
I'm just trying to loosen up a bit here. It was good. I just had a glug of water there. I've caught it. Of course, I saw Diane Abbott's comment on it. I don't think I need to comment on Diane Abbott commenting on anything much. I think everybody will know. Kiss of Death was sort of the first thing that ran through my mind. I mean, I'm not surprised by the media's reaction of how they've painted it. And I noticed that the political party or group that she set up, TTIP, is it TTIP or something? I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's Taking the Initiative Party.
Oh, good. Jolly good. They're maintaining that, no, it was it's not gang violence, that the media are lying to you, see. Now, all I note is that the communication process is so broken, there's no point even entering into it, would be my kind of take on it. Maybe it might recover, but it's just, no, what I say goes. No, what I say goes. No, what I say goes. There's no real hearing. Of course, the police now have to be portrayed as totally untrustworthy. And unfortunately, I can kind of understand why. You know, I'm no great fan myself in their current condition. They've not covered themselves in anything much other than probably audio. And they're just, you know, they're not a good advert for anything much. So when they say things, maybe in the past, the words of the chief constable or whatever would have been respected, or you'd have given some credence, but now it's very difficult. In the end, of course, it's part of this bigger problem of the presence of other people living in the wrong country. And I just keep coming back down to this as an engineering problem, you know, because they're talking about racial equality and all this other stuff is a condition that cannot be achieved ever. It's therefore pointless pursuing it because there's no such thing as equality. It's never existed in the whole of the known universe, a condition never, ever yet witnessed in anything. And it never will be. In fact, you could almost say that it's a law that physical life as we know it, one of the laws is the permanent absence at all times and in all places of anything approaching equality. It doesn't exist. And so therefore, if you're pursuing that, you're pursuing something that doesn't exist and you're not sane. So I just find nearly all of these words that they use, you know, in terms of Black Lives Matter, it's just a completely redundant comment. I don't bear them any ill will. I'm sure that amongst themselves, they may or may not matter, but I'm not in a position to judge because I am not of them. So what's the point of even commenting? I mean, I there's nothing I could say about it. It's down to them to sort the way that they want things to be sorted. And of course, we've got all these encroachments, do we not? I mean, this is part of the bigger picture of all these attacks via the culture. I noticed there's this thing coming up, isn't there, with what's her name? Henry VIII's lover being portrayed by a black actress. So this is all part of, I mean, this is just the latest in these things. I mean, they just don't stop. And they're done by all the lovies and the liberals, I suppose, to keep the thing agitated and going forward. But no one should get shot at a party. But I don't go to those sort of parties. And, you know, I don't wish any ill will on any of these people at all. It must be very unpleasant to get shot in the head. I don't know what to say about it, right? It's not good. But the way that the media have responded, does it surprise anybody here? I don't think so. It's what we're expecting, isn't it? Just comes with the territory. Right now, these days.
Well, thank you for that. It's not good to be shot in the head. That should be quote of the evening. Jason, my friend, what is your take on this? And obviously, from the American perspective, there have been some large movings on the race front in America because it is a year anniversary of George Floyd's sobriety. He's not been on drugs for a year, has he? So everyone's celebrating.
No, precisely. I saw that satire and I knew immediately that the anti-whites would come unglued because you're only allowed to satirize Western kind, mock us, ridicule us, and any joke anywhere else. And it's of course the height of the deepest of evils. Well, this is the anti-whites. And yeah, we do have, it is picking up here again in the U.S. It's getting hot. In fact, what is it today here in the once great state of Virginia? The temperature here is 97 Fahrenheit. So with the humidity, it's probably just over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, sticky and unpleasant. And that is, of course, a recipe for anti-whites, these anti-white terror troops, as they are, to enter the streets and to begin burning. And we saw actually just the other day that there were shots being fired at one of these celebrations or remembrances of this particular individual. It was all caught on news cameras. Fascinating. What a shock it was. But of course, what is happening with Sasha and what was happening and what will continue to happen is that you, if you are a Westman, man, woman, or child, will be blamed for her death. They, of course, the anti-whites came out in the news and entertainment media and implied that exactly as Mark was saying, that her death was a consequence of the white race and all that we do. And this is the anti-white narrative that we're forced to live under. So you will be forced as a white person now to be to take the blame, to take the shame. And even when they find out and they reveal that, well, it was a crossfire between different gangs. Well, the gangs wouldn't be gangs. They wouldn't be doing what they're doing if it weren't for you, the white race, causing them to have to behave this way. This is why you don't stay in their narrative when you discuss anything with our friends, family, and strangers whom we have to help, whom we have to empower with the lexicon and dialectics that enable them to pass on the curative contagion and eventually change the milieu in which the conversation and the laws and et cetera take place. But you won't be thanked for providing the white man's medical care to her, keeping her alive in the wake of that ringing in the ears that she's having. And you won't be thanked for the health care that she will require should she survive for the rest of her life. You won't be thanked by her family members for being able to be with her in whatever vegetative state or whatever she'll be in for the rest of her life. You won't be thanked by them for being able to put their arms around her. You are going to continue to be blamed. So the question is, why do we talk about it at all? What's the purpose of bringing it up? And Paul's asking that question. Well, the only reason to bring this up is not for all of the, and I know Mark will be able to vouch for me here. So many years of going to conferences and meetings and talking with people of similar mind. And every one of these instances is shared for the purpose of gallows laughter. Look at what they do to us, or what we have termed gallows glee, to have the worst story present and be able to derive some sort of pleasure from having the worst story present at the meeting or the group, or just a simple endless doom documenting of all the things that are going bad. Or even, I mean, we heard quite a little bit. This turned into a unexpected colloquium with our raconteur Paul. We have this endless, other places, this endless doom dissection of what exactly, where did it come from or whatever. We have to deal with where we are today and getting ourselves out of this hole so that our beautiful white babies don't have to live in this same deep, dank, dark pit that the anti-whites have placed us in. So I suggest that if you're going to discuss Sasha with friends, family, or strangers, only bring it up to talk about it now being a hush crime, because that is a meme curative that empowers you with unspoken premises and a thought chain that will enable you to come to the right conclusions and defeat your interlocutor, your audience, should they want to argue the opposite position. You bring it up, you call it a hush crime. The anti-whites are controlling the narrative, that therefore we are going to be blamed, even though, and the question of firearms in the hands of these individuals isn't even going to be raised. It's just all about when firearms are mentioned, it's all about how to deprive the law-abiding citizen of their right to self-defense. So bring up these stories in order to help those around us in a way that you empower them with a lexicon and dialectic so that they then go out into their circles of influence and recite those same things, those same statements, those same words that went over the people in their circles, and eventually this grows. It's not enough to just complain about these things or to know where they come from. We have to dig in and make the change, be the change that we want to see, as they are wont to say. But not a big surprise. I was kind of expected, actually, I'll pass it back to you, Mark. I was a bit surprised that the anti-whites over there in the UK did not use this as an opportunity to blame the white race, even though it ended up being crossfire. And perhaps that's yet to come. Perhaps it'll come to fruition, but we'll see.
Oh, I'm sure they'll find a way to blame us. No doubt these people were kept in such poverty by their cruel white overlords that they were forced into a life of shooting each other at garden parties. But let us do some super chats, because unbelievably, we are already a whole 75 minutes into this show. I can't believe how time is flying by tonight. So we have Bailiff Basher, who gave $25. Thank you very much. And he said, "Hi, Mark. Had my first BBC TV license goon at my door the other day. I have not paid the paedophile protection racket in well over 2 years now. I took great satisfaction in refusing to coerce and slamming the door in his face. Best wishes to yourself, Laura Towler, regional guys, membership and followers of PA. Well, well done, Bailiff Basher. Do not pay your TV license. Just ignore it. They've got no right to come into your house. And if you want to be even better, simply don't have a television connected to an aerial. I don't have a television connected to an aerial. Don't need one. I've got a television connected to a games console. I've got a monitor connected to a PC. And I don't use any form of catch-up TV. So legally, I don't have to have a license. I don't need one. The BBC is trash. Don't want to watch anything they produce. And as far as I'm concerned, everyone should do their bit. Deprive them of money. These people, they want their feet on your head. They want their foot on your head. And they want you basically as far down into the puddle as they can force you. They want you girdling your last because you are white. These people hate you. Do not fund them. You know, if you're saving a couple of hundred quid a year, put it to good use. Take yourself out, treat your missus, buy yourself something nice. But whatever you do, don't put it in the pockets of these anti-white globalists. Stan gave £10. Thank you very much. He said, very informative stream tonight and a great guest. Well, thank you very much. And he's indeed informative and a great guest. Please, if you want to ask questions, there is still time to super chat, and also you can still share this stream. We've got about 1,000 people watching over all platforms here, and then we've also got the people on Radio Album. We'll get those numbers later, but I think Paul deserves far more than just 1,000 people. It's been an amazing show tonight. Junta Mominari gave $10. Thank you very much. He said, are you aware of a survey taking of the 30% of Asians and Hispanics that vote for Trump, that voted for Trump after the 2017 Charlottesville riots? 70% agreed whites are under attack, and 53% endorsed the idea that the country needs to protect and preserve its white European heritage. Well, that's very interesting. Thank you for the chat. I know that there are lots of people who are of different ethnic groups that do actually support Patriotic Alternative, that don't want to see whites become a minority in the West, because they realise that if whites become a minority in the West, they too will suffer at the hands of the kind of, well, at the hands of the communists that are taking over. Serena JB gave £5. Thank you very much. She said, a really important topic. Thanks to Paul for explaining it so well. Well, thank you very much, Serena. Glenn the Chinaman gave $10. Thank you very much. And said, Syrian girl mentioned there was emigration from Israel, but these immigrants are like the Binyamin Eatery, who created the Chabad houses in Tokyo and Osaka. It's a strategy to maintain power. Israel doesn't exist without the diaspora, and their goal is to control all other nations as well. Well, I agree with that. Do you have anything to say about that, Paul?
That is their goal. I agree with that. I echo your sentiments exactly, Mark. Yes.
Well, I think it's a very important point, that actually. I think it's worth just taking a second on that Israel doesn't exist without the diaspora. If every single Jew did go to Israel, it wouldn't have the power it does. Israel exists because the diaspora exists, and the diaspora wields such disproportionate power in every nation where it exists, and that gives Israel its strength, mainly through control of, as you said, both the banking sector and the media.
Yes. And the law. Oh, and education. Oh, and I mean, are you familiar with the Byzantine solution to the problem? Because it works.
I'm not, but I'm hoping you're going to tell us.
I am going to tell you. So it all began a long, long time ago. Now, this is really important stuff. You will have heard of Eustace Mullins, and Mullins worked for Ezra Pound. Pound is an amazing figure, and I have him right up there. If I had any charts, he'd be pretty much up towards the top of them. Pound paid very heavily for his understanding of the problem. If you've read any of his political comments, he knew exactly what was going on in World War II, which is why he made the broadcasts he did from Italy, which enabled them to deem him a traitor. He wasn't. He was loyal to his people. He made some incredibly savage and vicious disparaging remarks about the English, which I totally agree with, along the lines of, you let this filth run your banking system and squander your empire down the toilet, you arseholes. That's the gist of it. He phrased it much better than I did, but I think modern vernacular works. Anyway, Pound discovered the Byzantine solution. So the Byzantine Empire is the longest lasting empire we know of. Surprisingly, it lasted over 1,000 years, and it ended about 1500 nod, or is it 1300 nod? Something like that, a few hundred years ago. Okay. And they had a policy, which was this: all aliens, i.e. non-Byzantine, and the Byzantine Empire is basically the Eastern Roman Christian Empire, were barred from the following fields of endeavor: barred, education, government, banking and politics. You were allowed in. It worked. That's why it lasted so long. That's why it lasted over 1,000 years. Everybody that lived there lived well, but if you were not of the nation, and you know, if I do the sort of the definition of the word nation, it's very important, I think. A tribe of people, all of the same race, bound together by a received and common language, history, and culture. That tells you who's in a nation and who isn't. It's a racial thing. And they managed to preserve those really well with that policy. And Pound said it's really easy. Just do this. And he's right. You'll find the quote somewhere if you look it up. So Pound's absolutely amazing. He paid very and his story, you know, he produces Eustace Mullins, who is in many ways kind of the godfather of the alternative inquiry movement in modern times. He really is. Yeah. Astonishing things that he did. Up until recent times, he was with us, wasn't he? Up until a few years ago. So a tremendous scholar, great communicator, and really went to town on the whole thing. So there you go. You want if we want our country back, or our nation back, you have to get clear, this is me speaking, about what a nation is. And I've had a lot of chats about English football teams with people for years. And they'll be watching England playing football or something, and they'll go, oh, it's a pity we lost. I'm going, well, we didn't lose. And they go, yeah, we did. There was a match, actually, that happened in 2018 in the World Cup. I think they lost to another team called Belgium. I'm often telling this one, but I like using football. It's good. And I said, no, we didn't lose. And they said, yeah, we did. I said, we didn't. We didn't field a team. You see, if you're going to have a national football team, everybody on that team has got to be from the same race. You better decide which one it's going to be. But if it's got more than one race in it, it ain't a national team. And not because I say so, but because the dictionary says so. And it has always said that. So, you know, the way that they use those things as well, they've used sport in particular as part of the cultural maladjustment of the whoop and woof of our life. Football is a joke compared to what it used to be like in terms of the passion and the connection between the crowd and the team, because it can't exist. Because there's not a national team on the pitch. They're great footballers, got nothing against any of them. Fantastic. Lovely if you like all that kind of stuff. I can give a fig about it. I'd rather see a bunch of useless buggers from my own race get thrashed, you know, because then it'd be fun. It'd be fun again. But these are just my particular peccadillos. I've kind of gone off. Let's not move away from they didn't play football in the Byzantine Empire, as far as I'm aware. But if they did, they would have fielded a jolly good national team, I'm sure, Mark.
Well, thank you for that excellent answer, Paul. Max Anderson gave £10. Thank you very much, my friend. And he said, such a great guest, a patriotic alternative bank, question mark. Well, hopefully we will take our nation back and we will do away with those who have captured our banking sector and are using it against us. Junta Mominari gave $10. Thank you very much, my friend. He said, are you aware US population could start shrinking as early as this year? Hispanics are the most fertile and their replacement rate has fell to 1.8. Immigration not only doesn't solve the problem of low births, it brings down fertility faster for everyone in the country. Thank you for that observation. I believe the only groups that are growing are the ones that are the most religiously devout. David Peterson gave £5. Thank you very much. He said, how good do you think it would be to be shot in the head on a scale of 1 to 10? I think there are questions for us all. With 10, but the problem is, David, you didn't say, is 10 good or bad? If 1 is bad and 10 is good, I'd say being shot in the head was a 1. What would you say, Paul?
Pretty bad, yeah. I'd say a 1-2. You know, Tom, who I was on with when we were on the other week, Tom Goodrich.
Yes.
He's doing he's got these little vignettes, these little short things that he writes up. He did one recently and he sent it to me. It's about he doesn't call it Wyatt Earp, it's a parody of that. He's talking about what actually happens to someone's head when a bullet goes into it. It's not good. I don't know what else you want me to say. I could give you all the graphic detail. Well, he did. He provided it to me. And basically what happens is, just for everybody who's really keen to know, if a bullet passes through the head, it goes through it so quickly that it sucks all the brains out of the hole at the back and it's just a big hollow chamber in there. It's called turning the head into a canoe. Don't say you didn't learn some physiology tonight.
Also, I will add to this, depending on the shape and the caliber of the bullet, and you can test this with a coconut, because a coconut is very much like a skull. If you shoot a coconut with a 7.62 round, it will shatter and you'll get the gooey, milky center splashed everywhere, but you will also get fragments of the outer coconut shell. Pretty much, you can actually eat it once you've shot it, but it's a great way to open it up, actually. But it gives a relatively accurate picture of what can happen to a skull. And if you've ever seen real-life crime photos, particularly from these Mexican drug wars, where two Mexican gangs have set about each other, they tend to use what could be described as military-grade weaponry. The state of what is left is pretty disturbing, I can tell you that.
Yeah, it's not sort of something that they're going to stitch back together and get it walking and talking again, I would imagine, Mark. It's a bit of a blow, I'm afraid.
If she's being shot in the head, it depends what part of the brain. And I should also imagine, because they've said she's been shot in the head, if she's been shot through the jaw or something like that, she might be fine. It's as if it has hit the brain and what part of the brain it went into. But fun fact, the guy from, you will remember this, Paul, people in the chat will, Jason won't have a clue what we're talking about, but can you remember the main character from A Low, A Low?
Was that a French thing where it's set in a French cafe or something?
Yes. And the main
I've never seen it though. I only know of it. I haven't watched television for years with things like that. So no, is it the restaurant owner? I'm assuming. I can't remember the cafe owner.
He was, I believe it's him. I'm just going to look this up actually. He was driving, and as he was driving, it's actually a sitcom that was set in World War II occupied France, and it was set in a cafe, and the Germans used to go there, and it was sort of a playoff between sort of the Germans and
I remember clips. Gordon Kay, they're writing in the Odyssey chat room. Gordon Kay, I was just looking at it, so thanks, chaps and chapesses, for it.
Gordon Kay, I think this is him. He actually suffered an incredible head injury. Yeah, I'm just looking at Wikipedia now, where a piece of wooden advertising hoarding smashed through the windscreen when he crashed and went into his skull and actually lodged in the brain. And he actually survived. He had retained a large scar on his forehead. But he actually lived out the rest of his life. So the brain is a funny thing, and it depends, obviously, where this woman was actually hit, the caliber of the bullet, whether it penetrated the brain. There's lots of different things, but I think we can all agree, to answer David Peterson's rather wacky question, not good to be shot in the head.
No, not good.
And another fun fact. If you are going to get shot with a bullet, actually, you would want to be hit with a very sharp armor-piercing bullet, which is as hard as possible, because it goes in and it comes out clean, whereas the worst bullets are the soft-tipped ones or the hollow-tipped ones, because they either break up inside of you or they leave an absolutely huge gaping exit wound. And if you've ever watched any of these criminology programs where they do forensic and stuff, I got really into those, you will see the difference in damage it causes depending on the type and composition of the bullet.
It's not the sort of thing that you can request, though, is it? In the heat of the moment. Hey, hang on. No, that's not one of those. I want one of these bullets.
Yeah, can you please use a different...
Could you please just... It's all right that you shoot me, but not with that type of bullet. I don't think that's going to happen, really.
Type of bullet.
Yeah.
Definitely not one with a hollow point. But yeah, it's very interesting. If you watch any of these forensic things... The actual difference, and they do all kinds of tests as well, where they sort of shoot jelly molds and other such things, which are meant to closely imitate the sort of feeling of the bullet entering the body, so they can actually watch it back in slow motion and see the damage. So there's some interesting facts. Anyway, Jez gave $25 and he said gyms, squash clubs, etc. suddenly open with few to no restrictions. Suspect the authorities are trying to give people some perceived freedom before they shut it all down again due to the Indian variant. People should get some exercise in while they're open. I know what Jez is saying. And I will be joining you to play some squash with you, Jez, but not while I'm ill, because as I said, I've got the sniffles. British Gammon gave £25. Thank you very much, my friend. He said, great show tonight, gentlemen. P.S. The earth is flat. Ha ha. Very good. I always get triggered by the flat earthers. Jacob gave $25. Thank you very much, my friend. He said, missed the first half due to work. Confident I'll enjoy on rewatch. So have the tip now. Well, thank you very much, my friend. That's the end of the Super Chats. There is still half an hour left if anyone wants to donate. Remember, all donations go towards me being able to do this as a full-time endeavour. The top-rated non-paid question is from 88th Brigade with 5 upvotes, and it said, thoughts on Tinney's nationalism. Now, what 88th Brigade is actually asking is, what do I think of nationalists who believe that nationalism should be wedded to drinking and basically drink culture? And I think that nationalism absolutely should not be wedded to alcohol or to a drinking culture. I've been involved for 20 years in nationalism, and at events where drinking has been encouraged, I've seen friends fight each other. I've seen members of the same families fall out and actually get into physical altercations. I've seen nationalists be glassed by other nationalists. I've seen sitting British National Party councillors involved in serious altercations, which have caused them to had to resign as councillors. I think wedding nationalism to drinking cheap lager and turning nationalism into some kind of absurd alcohol-centric social club is a very, very bad thing for us. And what I'll also say is, those that stream drunk and think that passing nationalist commentary whilst in a group of sort of 7 or 8 people on a stream where everyone's drinking or everyone's in a drunk state, I think that is a very, very bad thing to do. I think it's bad optics. I think it looks ridiculous. And I've seen people recently on streams who are drunk that have behaved in such a disgraceful and embarrassing fashion. They not only make fools of themselves, but they make the wider movement look ridiculous as an extension of that. And I think we need to be a professional, welcoming and intelligent, friendly and sober movement that builds our activities around things that enrich us, not pursuits that turn us into worse versions of ourselves. Because I think we can all agree, when we are a little bit worse for where we drink, we are not the best versions of ourselves. I don't know if either of you have got any takes on what you think to, as 88th Brigade called it, tinny nationalism. When he says tinnies, he means like cans of lager.
Well, Jason would know all about that, wouldn't you, Jason?
No. I don't almost
it's an English thing, is it?
No. We do have it, regrettably. We do have it here. We've suffered from the same thing in the United States with these individuals who they believe that this, I don't know, you might refer to it then as beer nationalism or alcohol nationalism, alcoholism nationalism, and other types of drugs. This is one of the things that many of us, I think, obviously the best among us have been pulling the other direction and endeavoring. And we do a very, very good job in service to white well-being with our practice of going free, of turning people around. And that's one of the things that I have argued for very long needs to be the focus of any endeavor to recapture our destiny, is the individual improving him or herself in a really fundamental and substantive way. They had to experience that change for themselves. You can, I guess you can analogize that as a microcosm to the macrocosm of some of those historical events that maybe you all were talking about a little bit earlier. But they need to change themselves in a fundamental way so that they see that getting out of the anti-white narrative, that embracing this new practice that is like working out or eating right, that they see that there is a definite change, something tangible. Those around them see that there's a definite change, something tangible for the better. And that they then go from being motivated in some of these very ugly ways, these villainous ways, taking on the villainy character in the anti-white narrative, to something wholesome, true, and loving. And they end up accessing many of their latent abilities that they otherwise had clouded from, or were clouded from various sources, such as the meme pathogens, but certainly from alcoholism and drugs. And as a consequence, others around them see that they are improving. They want to know what is the cause of that improvement. And by just the proximity, by just osmosis, almost receiving the lexicon and dialectics that these individuals use, which are improving themselves, they then begin to see that improvement. And it spreads, that's why we call it a curative contagion. It spreads then, and you have a verbiage that works for you, arguments that work for you, that improve you in your life, and that enable you to defeat the anti-whites who are around you, and these vagues out there, lemmings or whatever you want to call them, those vagues out there, brothers and sisters who we have to bring over to this practice in order to change our individual lives, learning finally, once and for all, as individualistic as we are, genetically speaking, a predisposition that seems to be greater than the other races of man, finally learning that our individual well-being is only attainable by way of our group's well-being, something that other groups do very, very well. So it is critically important to get away from this sort of beer nationalism, or whatever you want to call it, to improve yourself. And as Mark was saying, to improve the image that people see. Why? Not because I saw somebody write in the comments a moment ago, and I always see this idea that it's an optical illusion. It's optics. It's just about optics. No, you are on a wrong path. If you believe that this is an optical illusion, then you are on a villainy path. You have embraced a villainy caricature from the anti-white narrative. And you are saying that, no, you don't want to cover this up with some sort of clean optics. You want to just purity spiral into being the best villain in their narrative that you can be. Well, I say hogwash to that. You get out of their story where you be the villain into our story where you are the hero. And the hero is somebody who is sober, sane, and glorious, a real man, woman, and child of the West, living their lives for the good of our people as a whole, and therefore for the good of their individual lives.
Well, thank you for that. I think we're all agreed on this, that nationalism should be about excellence. It should be about striving for something better, raising us up. Nationalism shouldn't be about a race to the bottom. It shouldn't be about gangs of lads getting together, drinking as much as they can and making everyone else feel uncomfortable. And one of the things that I'm most proud about with PA events is that they're not based around drinking. We have strict policies on things like that. And when we have camps, when we have hikes, if people turn up and they get drunk, they're not invited back. And if people aren't in a fit state to do the hikes, they're told to go home. You know, we don't want people at our events who are using our events as a way to get hammered. That's not what we're about. We're a community-based movement. We're not a group that's there to bring out the worst in people. And I got to say this, I think alcohol, especially cheap supermarket alcohol that you drink at home, is a major, major problem for our people. And when you see how many families it damages, how many people's lives it ruins, how many relationships cheap supermarket alcohol damages, it's not good. You know, if you're at home, take up a hobby, do something, but don't just sit drinking on your own, because it will lead you to your ruination. But I think we've covered that topic. Some of the people in the chat obviously have had a few things to say about this, and it's great to see people's opinions. Pleasant Pheasant Plucker gave £3 and said, Paul's a great guest. He certainly is. And he says, with what happened to the organization from the 1970s, Chadwick Boseman, and now with this girl, in your professional opinions, is the mantle of Black Panther cursed? Well, it certainly does look that way. It certainly does look that way. Chadwick Boseman, he was the Black Panther. He is dead. Sasha Johnson, she was a Black Panther of Oxford. She's now there with a bullet in the head. Is it like the curse of Superman? Because for a while, they said the part of Superman was cursed. If you played Superman, it was like a curse. Well, it seems that has now befallen those who take on the title of Black Panther. And Snoops gave £25. Thank you very much, my friend. He said, superb guest. Love you guys. Was the sinking of the Titanic linked to the founders of the Federal Reserve? Well, I'll give that one over to Paul because I don't know about that.
I would say yes, it was. Yeah, because what was his name? Vanderbilt's, was it? Basically, there were some pretty powerful, they would be billionaires of today, but multimillionaires of the time, who opposed the formation of the Fed. They opposed it. There is a wonderful conspiracy theory going around that a Jesuit priest out of Ireland was responsible for organizing it. It's difficult to know exactly how, but I suspect that the main thing about the Titanic is that it wasn't the Titanic, it was the sister ship that had the name switched that had run aground during trials. That seems to be highly likely. But there's a lot of evidence. Yeah, I mean, the people that were on that ship were, they were the, some of them, the great movers and shakers of the day. It's the Astor family I'm thinking of. It's the Astor family. And he was strongly opposed to the Fed. And as I said, they slipped it through while everybody was away. Just, they'd all gone home early for Christmas. And hence, everything turned pretty bad. I mean, it only took them what? When's Wall Street crash? 16 years later? It took them 16 years to completely destroy it. It was all artificially created. Total bogus event. It didn't affect Churchill, though, because his pals told him well ahead of time, and he did all right. Thank you very much. Because the fix was in for some time. So
that's a really interesting point. I just want to hop in there because a lot of people don't know this. And I was actually shocked when I found out, because there's this sort of myth about the Titanic that it was this one of a kind super boat, the world's biggest boat. There would only be one of them like this. And it was unthinkable. And then you find out there was actually two and they only launched one that sank. And then you start to hear about potential insurance claims, some kinds of fraud, one of the ships being actually damaged and uninsurable. So that was the one that was taken out, nameplates being changed, and all kinds of other things about this. There's actually a lot about it. And I know that you've talked a little bit about National Socialist Germany today, but National Socialist Germany actually made a film about the Titanic with a very interesting social narrative about, which was a critique basically of capitalism. I don't know if you've heard of that film.
I haven't. No, I'm intrigued. I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, I'll have to look it up now. But do you have any other facts on the Titanic, or does Jason? Because it is an interesting topic.
I don't. I can't remember the name of the priest, but he was a Jesuit priest. There's quite a bit about it involved with that. Lots of forces at play to get that thing rolling, the Fed. I think the interesting thing about the Fed is what was happening before it, just by way of background, which they had to squelch. After the Civil War in America, the economy was going through the roof. Lots of natural resources, as we're all well aware. Lots of appetite to get on and do things. If we were developing a business today, the bank expects you to go and see them to make a loan to build the factory, for example. And that's what they were expecting after this Civil War. But it stopped happening. It kept reducing. And the reason it did is that people that were manufacturing things, say shoes or whatever, I don't know. Let's suppose you've got somebody in Baltimore and he wants to open one up in San Francisco, they didn't go and borrow the money from the bank. They just paid for it out of their own flow and revenue and savings. They didn't need banks. People that are aware of it, you need a bank. You don't. No, if you don't allow them to interfere with it, you don't need them in that capacity. So they organized and worked to crush. I think they bought up a lot of farming land. So they foreclosed on a lot of farms in the 1880s, I think it was, maybe 1890s, to lay in all these causative reasons to say in the press, which they also controlled, hey, we need a flexible currency supply. No, you don't. But that's what they wanted. And therefore, you need this thing called the Federal Reserve. And hey, presto, another stitch-up job. So very similar to the Central Bank of England, and it's the same international banking families behind both. Grotty little businesses.
Well, I've pulled up the information about the 1943 version of Titanic, and it states that the in the plot section on Wikipedia, people can look this up. An epilogue states that the deaths of 1,500 people remain an unatoned, an internal condemnation of Britain's endless quest for profit. And the theme of the film is the faults of capitalism and the stock market, and they play a dominant role throughout the movie. And basically, it shows that the British ruling class at the time had very, very little care or love for the working class people, and the upper class people didn't really care at all for the working class who were trapped below deck and were drowning. And actually, it's quite interesting reading that, because that pretty much is the plot of the much more famous modern retelling of that story, starring Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio, which does show that the upper class in the film were pretty much unmoved by the plight of the working class. And in a way, that film is a bit of a critique of the capitalist system too. But that's quite interesting. If anyone wants to look that up, that's the 1943 version of Titanic, which does seem to have some parallels with the, as I say, the much more famous one. We have another super chat here from Ryan354 for £5. And he says, fantastic guest. Do you have any thoughts on the second letter written to the French government by their military, warning of civil war? I don't, unfortunately, but I don't know if Paul or Jason does. Obviously, Ryan's talking about the issue with the French generals writing an open letter to the French government saying that multiculturalism will lead to civil war in France unless something is done now. I don't know if you guys have any opinion on that.
Well, I agree with them. I think, I would say there's no such thing as multiculturalism. That's just the way I think of it. I don't think there is such a thing, because I'm very interested in taking hold of these phrases that they've embossed, as it were, onto our heads and into our speech and shredding them. They don't exist. There's no such thing as multiculturalism. What you end up with is, it's like oil and water. You end up with pools of people basically rotating and moving around one another, and someone stands afar off and goes, look, it's a multicultural society. It is not. It's a mess. It doesn't work.
The people in the chat are saying the second letter was played down by the press in the UK because it mentioned the French version of the ADL and talked about Jewish power, basically.
Did it?
Apparently, wow. So this is what they're saying in the chat. So I just thought I'd throw that in there, Paul, because I thought that might interest you.
Yeah, no, I thought I was kind of familiar with it, but I'm not. I haven't seen that reference. I'm definitely aware of the first one. And of course, the French do have a tendency to really seriously kick off when it really goes. Of course, we should be suitably embarrassed by it, I think, over here. But of course, we've become extremely sort of tame in comparison to how we used to be. Or maybe it's just that always our violence has always been organized by the government. So as long as the government tell us to be violent, we'll do it great. We'll really get stuck in. But we would rather it's bad form to do it, you know, off your own bat. We don't want to be doing that. It's just not a good show, is it? But yeah, I mean, you know, the French Revolution, of course, is a key part of the psychology, I suggest, of the French. I think it devastated that nation in more ways than we can consider. It's a horrific event. And I think modern times are kind of a rerun of that to some degree, very much similar sort of processes taking place. It might not look the same form-wise, but the essence of the movements are very similar. I don't know what they're going to do over there. I have no idea. I mean, Macron, of course, or Microbe, or whatever he's called, he's obviously a very silly person, but supported by, you know, the same crew behind the back. So we would just have to see. Didn't they, after the first one, I think the media really had a go at all the generals, and are we surprised? No, of course we're not surprised. But if they've issued a second letter, I do need to get my eyeballs on that. I'd like to see it.
maybe some homework for after the show there. We've got another question. We've got a question from Rory Herbert. This is a non-paid one. He says, have the Metropolitan Police arrested anyone yet in the Sasha Johnson case? And if not, why not? Well, I actually believe they have. And I want to bring up a little something. I've got this on my phone. And I think they have arrested three teenagers and two adult males in the case. Yes, five held over Sasha Johnson attempted murder. Police arrest four drug dealers, then detain fifth man following car chase 3 days after BLM activist was shot in the head during, in inverted commas, melee at Peckham party. So five men aged between 17 and 28 remain in custody on suspicion of attempted murder of Sasha Johnson. Sasha Johnson's political party continues to reject the idea that the Black Panther of Oxford was caught in the crossfire. So what they're basically saying, police say a gang of four men ran into a garden and shot into the crowd of partygoers before fleeing the scene. Mother of two is fighting for her life following an attack in Peckham, South East London, on Sunday. Scotland Yard insists there is nothing to suggest Miss Johnson was the target of the shooting because of activism. So basically, the people she was hanging around with are most likely, allegedly, members of a rival gang were involved in some kind of drug feud. Their rivals turned up to exact some kind of revenge. There was at least a fight or some kind of, they called it a melee. And eventually somebody produced a gun, opened fire, and she got hit. But obviously the BLM brigade are maintaining that this was somehow an attack on her because Black people don't do this kind of thing, so it's nice of them to inform us of that. And I will look forward to subsequent trials and press coverage of that. So thank you for the question, Rory. Kelt asks, what must we do to bring a far wider audience to our media and discussion? If they never hear the arguments, we will never persuade. Well, this is one of the problems with being deplatformed, unfortunately. We're in this position where we used to have YouTube. You know, we used to get videos with literally millions of views. I remember I produced a video on the incident where a school in America, Jason might remember the name, they had a no whites allowed day. So it was a day where white children weren't allowed to attend. And that video had 1.1 million views. And I had other ones about Europeans being written out of their own history that had 900,000 views. And we've had all that taken away from us. So the only way for us to get our views up on these platforms is if people share the stream and get their friends to watch it, suggest their family members watch it, get people signing up to Odyssey, get people signing up to BitChute. I mean, I think BitChute's an amazing platform. I think Odyssey's an amazing platform. Odyssey has both live streaming and its own crypto. It also has a massive range of different content on there. Everyone I know is uploading their videos there, and videos are in HD. You know, get your friends, get your family watching this, share the streams to them, get them watching on BitChute and Odyssey. That's the best thing we can do. If you want to get the message out, you can't just sit there and expect it to spread itself. We don't have YouTube anymore. We don't have the old fair YouTube algorithm where Iconoclast, it would suggest a video from me or Laura Tower. Now, if you do get some pseudo-nationalist content on YouTube, it will give you a video from Hope Not Hate, a video use the YouTube algorithm. What do we have to do? Well, we have to share it ourselves. And, you know, we have, as I said, at peak tonight, we've had about 1,000 viewers across Entropy, DLive, and Odyssey. If all of those viewers manage to share that to one person, well, we double our numbers. And we need to start doing that. We need to we need to spread the word of what we're doing. And that's what PA exists for. That's why we're out leafleting. That's why we're out doing community politics. We need to spread our message in multiple ways, because we can't rely on big social networks anymore where we could reach the blue ocean. It's unfortunate, but that's how it is. And Real Mermaid is typing, asked, we've got two more paid super chats. Real Mermaid is typing, as you mentioned earlier this year, is going to be a PA alternative, the PA story writing competition. Is that going to happen? It is, but we've had a few issues with arrests and other things. And unfortunately, we are trying to work as hard as we can with reduced capacity. Max Anderson gave £3. Thank you very much. He said, the truth is on our side. We will have our home again. Thank you very much, my friend. We indeed will. And Pleasant Pheasant Plucker gave another £3. Thank you very much. He said, according to Diane Abbott, Sasha got shot for standing up for racial injustice. Maybe she did. Maybe the drug dealers had had enough of her Marxist white hate. Well, thank you very much for that. But that does bring us about to the end of the show last night. But we do have one last question, if Paul would answer this as quickly as he possibly can, because we are getting short on time. Kelt asked, what do you think of positive money, aka sovereign money?
Oh, ugh. Not much, because my brain's empty of it. And I've heard the phrase, and I can't tell you, I don't know quite what he's referring to. So my apologies for coming across goofy and absent-minded. So I don't know. I've got it written down somewhere in the back of my head. But I don't know what the term sovereign money refers to. So my apologies for that, but I don't know what it refers to. Useless answer, wasn't it?
I was asking that because it's something to do with banking. So, unfortunately, not the answer the person who asked the question hoped for. But we have had a fantastic night. So, but we are unfortunately near the end of the show. So, what I was going to say is, Paul, if you could give us an outro, if you could tell us where we can find your excellent work, if you could tell us how we can support your work and give us some final thoughts, that would be very much appreciated.
Sure, yeah. Well, there's not really a place for me just yet. I have an account on Gab. I'm not as active on it as I should be, but that's just gab.com/Paul English. That's about my only permanent residence in any space. But what I would point everybody to is moneytreepublishing.com, because that's where Tom's book is. There are several other books. In fact, Mark, while we've been talking, Dave, the publisher who's listening in, can you believe it? He sends me a thing saying apparently they've got a book coming out on the Titanic. That's all I know. It might be the blueprints. I don't think it is. But there's a book coming out on the Titanic, so there's that there.
Is that Dave from Money Tree Publishing watching?
Well, he's either watching or listening, but he should be working. Get on, Dave, crack that Dave, whip.
Get in touch with me, because the person who was doing – get in touch with me and we'll get another review of a Money Tree Publishing book on next month's book review, if you want. So
that's great, Mark. Thank you for the invite. Yeah, I'll pass that on to him as well.
If you have anything to do with that book, you'd be welcome on as well, Paul. You're always a welcome guest.
Cool. Well, one thing, just a comment to what you were just saying a few minutes ago about YouTube and all these other spaces. I never rated those things anyway, right? Seriously, they're not. I've never felt that those would be the ways in which you would build and do the audience thing. These structures like Odyssey are better, but what I suspect is needed are certain marketing stunts, in a way. One that I keep thinking about, it's about numbers. Basically, when everybody sees that a lot of people are congregating around a group of ideas which have to be simplified, we've got to really simplify this thing, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It grows at an exponential rate. Of course, everybody says, it's like the Facebook thing. I've got 1 million likes or whatever it is on Facebook. Yawn. I mean, these people don't even exist. It's a waste of time, in my view. I've never had a Facebook account, and I would never be using any of those sorts of things. I mean, it's so 20th century, whatever it is. Do you know what I mean? But we have to build our own media. That's it. We have to do it. And that means our own radio gigs, our own video platforms. I know a lot of people that do that. I spend most of my time on the ground working on things like that, looking at how we can crack those things. But a marketing stunt would be, I will stop paying my BBC TV license if 1 million other license holders will do the same. I like a million. That's something really big. You want to crush the BBC? We all stop, 1 million of us stop paying it on a Monday morning. But the process of gathering those people together would be a delight. You know, we might get 1 million, you might only get 50. You wouldn't actually. I think you get quite a few. But there's a great marketing campaign around that. The BBC is the greatest weapon arranged against the British people right now. It's the number one weapon because it's absorbing their heads with garbage. So the faster we can sever that thing, smash it, and give it back to the British, the better. So we have to find a way of doing that.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. And when we finish this stream, if you can put your links in the private chat or on the Skype, better still in Skype for me, sure. I'll make sure everyone can find your excellent work. So thank you so much for being with us. It's been a great,
been great
pleasure. Thank you, Jason. Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, Paul. And I hope, hopefully, if you have anything to do with the books that Dave will be talking to us about, you'd be welcome on the book review too. Jason, my friend, can you give yourself an outro and remind us who is on tap and where we can find you?
Well, we're still looking for that person for tap, and it's probably going to be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, somewhere around there. You'll be able to find it on my numerous platforms that we endeavor to stay on and to be able to bring a message of service, hope, and redemption to white well-being. So make sure that you find and join us, nowhiteguilt.org, nowhiteguilt.org, theafterparty.tv, theafterparty.tv. That's a resilient website. Everything is stored there on alternative sites so that the anti-whites can't take it down no matter what they do. We'll still be there for you all. It has been an absolutely splendid time with Paul today and all of you and our great leader, Mark Hollett. I really enjoyed myself and I hope and look forward to another great conversation next Wednesday. But looking for more of Paul, I hope to see you on more channels. And
nice to meet you, Jason. Stuff. Yeah, enjoyed it.
The honor nice is all mine, brother.
Well, thank you so much. It has been a great show. We've had just around 1,000 people watching on DLive, Odyssey, and Entropy, with 2,000 watching on Radio Albion. So that's 3,000 viewers tonight. Fantastic numbers. But I have to say it, Paul does deserve more. So if you enjoyed the show, please make sure you share the replays because I think it's been a cracking one. Well, I will be back later this week. I will be back on Friday with Laura Towler to do a monthly PA roundup. I will be back on Saturday night debating Jeremy Poole from Wake Up UK on civic nationalism versus ethno-nationalism. And I'll be back on Sunday for the PA Book Club, where we will be reviewing a book about the COVID scamdemic. So please tune in for all three of those things. So that just leaves me to say a huge, huge thank you. Huge thank you to Paul and to Jason. A massive thank you to all those who donated so generously this evening. And as always, the biggest thank you goes out to our amazing audience of 3,000 people who tuned in live. Thank you so much for joining us. I love this community. This is why we fight. I hope you all stay very well. Stay strong, keep fighting, and I will see you again very soon. Good night, everyone.